And, but then he bit off his words and instead looked up at his type commander. Bart, I can't argue with the data, sir. If there were a way to dispute it, Wally or I would have found it. The people at Sosus concur. It's hard for me to believe, too, Mancuso conceded. Charlotte has failed to check in. Why didn't her beacon go off, Sinkpak asked. The gadget is located on the sail, aft corner. Some of my skippers weld them down. The fast attack guys resisted putting them aboard last year, remember? Anyway, the fish could have destroyed the BST, or for some reason it didn't deploy properly. We have that noise indicator at Charlotte's approximate location, and she's failed to respond to an emergency order to communicate with us. There is no reason, sir, to assume that she's still alive. And now that Mancuso had said it, it was official. There was one more thing that needed to be said. You're telling me we're at war. The statement was delivered in an eerily quiet voice, ComSubPac noted. Yes, sir, I am. I didn't have any warning at all, Seaton objected. Yeah. You have to admire their sense of tradition, don't you? Jones observed, forgetting that the last time there had been ample warning. All of it unheeded. Pete Burrows didn't finish his fifth beer of the day. The night had not brought peace. Though the sky was clear and full of stars, brighter lights continued to approach Saipan from the east, taking advantage of the trade winds to ease their approach into the island's two American-built runways. Each jumbo jet had to be carrying at least 200 soldiers, probably closer to 3. They could see the two airfields. Orez's binoculars were more than adequate to pick out the aircraft and the fuel trucks that scurried about to fill up the arriving jets, so that they could rapidly go home to make another shuttle run. It didn't occur to anyone to keep a count until it was a few hours too late. Car coming in, Burrows warned, alerted by the glow of turning lights. Areza and he retreated to the side of the house, hoping to be invisible in the shadows. The car was another Toyota Land Cruiser, which drove down the lane, reversed direction at the end of the cul-de-sac, and headed back out after having done not very much of anything but look around and perhaps count the cars in the various driveways, more likely to see if people were gathered in an inopportune way. "You have any idea what to do?" he asked Areza when it was gone. "Hey, I was Coast Guard, remember? This is Navy shit. No, more like Marine shit." "It sure is deep shit, man. You suppose anybody knows?" "They got her." "Somebody's got her," Portuguese said, lowering the glasses and heading back into the house. "We can watch from inside our bedroom. We always leave the windows open anyway. The cool evenings here, always fresh and comfortable from the ocean breezes, were yet another reason for his decision to move to Saipan. "What exactly do you do, Pete?" "Computer industry. Several things, really. I have a master's in EE. My real specialty area is communications. How computers talk to each other. I've done a little government work. My company does plenty, but mostly on another side of the house." Burrows looked around the kitchen. Mrs. Oreza had prepared a light dinner, a good one, it appeared, though it was growing cold. "You were worried about having people track in on your phone." "Maybe just being paranoid, but my company makes the chips for scanners that the Army uses for just that purpose." Oreza sat down and started shoveling some of the stir-fry onto his plate. "I don't think anything's paranoid any more, man." "I hear you, Skipper." Burrows decided to do the same, and looked at the food with approval. "Y'all trying to lose weight?" Oreza grunted. "We both need to, Izzy and me. She's been taking classes in low-fat stuff." Burrows looked around. Though the home had a dining room, like most retired couples, that's how he thought of them, even though they clearly were not, they ate at a small table in their kitchen. The sink and counter were neatly laid out, and the engineer saw the steel mixing and serving bowls. The stainless steel gleamed. Isabel Oreza, too, ran a tight ship, and it was plain enough who was the skipper at home. "Do I go to work tomorrow?" she asked, her mind drifting, trying to come to terms with the change in local affairs. "I don't know, honey," her husband replied. His own thoughts stopped cold by the question. What would he do? Go fishing again as though nothing at all had happened? "Wait a minute," Pete said, still looking at the mixing bowls. He stood, took the two steps needed to reach the kitchen counter, and lifted the largest bowl. It was 16 inches in diameter and a good 5 or 6 inches deep. The bottom was flat, perhaps a 3-inch circle, but the rest of it was spherical, almost parabolic in shape. He pulled his sat phone out of his shirt pocket. He'd never measured the antenna, but now, extending it, he saw it was less than 4 inches in length. Burroughs looked over at Areza. "You have a drill?" "Yeah, why?" "DF hell, I got it." "You lost me, Pete." "We drill a hole in the bottom, put the antenna through it. The bowl's made out of steel. It reflects radio waves just like a microwave antenna. Everything goes up. Hell, it might even make the transmitter more efficient."
"You mean like ET phone home?"
"Close enough, Captain. What if nobody's phoned home on this one?" Burroughs was still trying to think it through, coming to terms, slowly, with a very frightening situation. Invasion meant war. War, in this case, was between America and Japan, and however bizarre that possibility was, it was also the only explanation for the things he'd seen that day. If it was a war, then he was an enemy alien, so were his hosts. But he'd seen Areza do some very fancy footwork at the marina. "Let me get my drill. How big a hole you need?" Burroughs handed over the sat phone. He'd been tempted to toss it through the air, but stopped himself on the realization that it was, perhaps, his most valuable possession. Areza checked the diameter of the little button at the end of the slim metal whip and went for his tool kit.
"Hello?"
"Rachel, it's Dad."
"You sure you're okay? Can I call you guys now?"
"Honey, we're fine, but there's a problem here."
How the hell to explain this, he wondered. Rachel Areza Chandler was a prosecuting attorney in Boston, actually looking forward to leaving government service and becoming a criminal lawyer in private practice, where the job satisfaction was rarer, but the pay and hours were far better. Approaching 30, she was now at the stage where she worried about her parents in much the same way they'd once worried about her. There was no sense in worrying Rachel now, he decided.
"Could you get a phone number for me?"
"Sure. What number?"
"Coast Guard headquarters. It's in D.C. at Buzzards Point. I want the watch center. I'll wait," he told her.
The attorney put one line on hold and dialed D.C. information. In a minute, she relayed the number, hearing her father repeat it word for word back to her.
"That's right. You sure things are okay? You sound a little tense."
"Mom and I are just fine, honest baby."
She hated it when he called her that, but it was probably too late to change him. Papa would just never be PC.
"Okay, you say so. I hear that storm was really bad. You have electricity back yet?" she asked, forgetting that there hadn't been a storm at all.
"Not yet, honey, but soon, probably," he lied.
"Later, baby."
"Coast Guard Watch Center Chief Officer for Brecky, this is a non-secure line," the man said, just as rapidly as possible, to prevent the person on the other end from understanding a single word. "Are you telling me that that fuzzy-cheeked infant who sailed on Panache with me made chief?"
It was good enough to startle the man at the other end, and the reply was comprehensible.
"This is Chief of Brecky. Who's this?"
"Master Chief Areza," was the answer.
"Well, how the hell are you, poor de Gee? I heard you retired."
The chief of the watch leaned back in his chair. Now that he was a chief himself, he could refer to the man at the other end by his nickname.
"I'm on Saipan."
"Okay, kid, listen up. Put your watch officer on right now."
"What's the matter, Master Chief?"
"No time, okay? Let's do it."
"Fair enough."
Obrecki put the call on hold.
"Commander, could you pick up on one, ma'am?"
"NMCC, this is Rear Admiral Jackson," Robbie said, tired and in a very foul mood. Only reluctantly did he lift the phone on the recommendation of a youngish Air Force major.
"Admiral, this is Lieutenant Commander Powers, Coast Guard, over at Buzzards Point. I have a call on the line from Saipan. The caller is a retired Command Master Chief, one of ours."
"Damn it, I have a broke carrier division out there," his mind raged.
"That's nice, Commander. You want to clue me in fast? It's busy here."
"Sir, he reports a lot of Japanese troops on the island of Saipan."
Jackson's eyes came up off the dispatches on his desk.
"What?"
I can patch him over now, sir.
Okay, Robbie said guardedly. Who's this?
Another voice asked, old and gruff. He sounded like a chief, Robbie thought.
I'm Rear Admiral Jackson in the National Military Command Center.
He didn't have to order a tape on the line. They were all taped.
Sir, this is Master Chief Quartermaster Manuel Areza, U.S. Coast Guard retired, serial number 328-614030. I retired 5 years ago and moved to Saipan. I operate a fishing boat out here. Sir, there are a lot of, and I mean a whole goddamn piss pot full of Japanese troops, uniformed and carrying arms on this here rock right now, sir.
Jackson adjusted his hand on the phone, gesturing for another officer to pick up.
Master Chief, I hope you understand that I find that a little bit hard to believe, okay? Shit, sir, you ought to see it from my side. I'm looking out my window right now. I can see down on the airport in Cobler Field. I count a total of 6 jumbo jet aircraft, 4 at the airport and 2 at Cobler. I observed a pair of F-15 Eagle fighters with meatball markings circling over the island a few hours ago. Question, sir, is there any sort of joint exercise underway at this time?
The voice asked.
It was stone sober, Jackson thought.
It sure as hell sounded like a command, Master Chief.
The Air Force Major listening 15 feet away was scribbling notes, though an invitation to Jurassic Park would have seemed somewhat more realistic.
We just concluded a joint exercise, but Saipan didn't have anything to do with it.
Sir, then this ain't no fucking exercise. There are 3 car carrier-type merchant ships tied alongside the dock up the coast from me. One of them's named Orchid Ace. I have personally observed military-type vehicles, I think MLRS, Mike, Lima, Romeo, Sierra, 6 of those, sitting in the parking lot at the commercial dock area. Admiral, you can check with the Coast Guard and pull my package. I did 30 years in CG Blue. I ain't dicking around, sir. Check for yourself. The phone lines to the rock are out. The story, supposedly, that we had a big windstorm, took lines down and stuff. Ain't been no windstorm, Admiral. I was out fishing all day, okay? Check with your weather pukes to confirm that one, too. There are Japanese troops on this island wearing fatigue uniforms and underarms.
You got to count, Master Chief.
The best confirmation of this insane tale, Robbie thought, was the embarrassed tone of the answer to that question.
No, sir. Sorry, I didn't think to count the airplanes. I'd guess 3 to 6 arrivals per hour over the last 6 hours at least, probably more. But that's just a guess, sir.
Wait. Cobler, one of the birds is moving like to take off.
It's a 747, but I can't make out the markings.
Wait. If the phones are out, how are you talking to me?
Areza explained, giving Jackson a conventional number to call back on.
Okay, Master Chief, I'm going to do some checking here. I'll be back to you in less than an hour. Fair enough?
Yes, sir. I figure we done our part.
The line went dead.
Major,
Jackson shouted without looking up. When he did that, he saw the man was there.
Sir, I know he sounded normal and all, but call Anderson Air Force Base right now.
Roger. The young pilot went back to his desk and flipped open his Autobahn directory. 30 seconds later, he looked up and shook his head, a curious look on his face.
Is someone telling me, Jackson asked the ceiling, that a U.S. Air Force base dropped off the net today and nobody noticed?
Admiral, sync pack on your STU, sir. It's coded as critic traffic.
Critic was a classification of priority even higher than flash and not a prefix often used, even by a theater commander-in-chief.
What the hell, Jackson thought.
Why not ask?
Admiral Seaton, this is Robbie Jackson. Are we at war, sir?
His part in the exercise seemed easy enough, Zhang Hansan thought. Just one flight to one place to talk first with one person, then another, and it had gone even more easily than he'd expected. Well, he shouldn't have been surprised, he thought, returning to the airport in the back of the embassy car. Korea would be cut off, certainly for a period of months and perhaps indefinitely. To do anything else would have carried with it great dangers for a country whose military had been downsized
and whose next-door neighbor was the nation with the world's largest standing army, and an historical enemy at that. Han hadn't even been forced to bring up that unseemly thought. He'd simply delivered an observation. There seemed to be difficulties between America and Japan. Those difficulties did not pertain directly to the Republic of Korea, nor would it appear that the Republic had any immediate ability to ameliorate those differences, except perhaps as an honest broker of influence when diplomatic negotiations were undertaken, at which time the good offices of the Republic of Korea would be most welcome indeed by all sides in the dispute, certainly by Japan. He had taken no particular pleasure at the discomfort his mild words had given to his hosts. There was much to admire in the Koreans, a fact lost on Japan in their blind racism, Zhang thought. With luck, he might firm up the trading relationship between the PRC and the ROK, and they, too, would profit from the ultimate objective, and why not? The ROKs had no reason to love the Russians, and even less to love the Japanese. They simply had to get over their regrettable friendship with America and become part of a new reality. It was sufficient to the moment that they had indeed seen things his way, and that America's one remaining ally in this part of the world was off the playing field, their president and foreign minister having seen the light of reason. And, with luck, the war, such as it was, might already be over for all intents and purposes. "Ladies and gentlemen," the voice came from the living room where Mrs. Oreza had left the TV on. "In 10 minutes there will be a special announcement. Please stay tuned."
"Manny?" "I heard it, honey."
"You have a blank tape for your VCR?" Burroughs asked. Chapter 23, the last chapter, Catching Up. Robbie Jackson's day had started off badly enough. He'd had bad ones before, including a day as a lieutenant commander at Naval Air Test Center, Patuxent River, Maryland, in which a jet trainer had decided, without any prompting at all, to send him and his ejection seat flying through the canopy, breaking his leg in the process and taking him off flight status for months. He'd seen friends die in crashes of one sort or another, and even more often had participated in searches for men whom he'd rarely found alive, more often locating a slick of jet fuel and perhaps a little debris. As a squadron commander and later as a CAG, he'd been the one who'd written the letters to parents and wives, telling them that their man, and most recently their little girl, had died in the service of their country, each time asking himself what he might have done differently to prevent the necessity of the exercise. The life of a naval aviator was filled with such days. But this was worse, and the only consolation was that he was Deputy J-3, responsible to develop operations and plans for his country's military. Had he been part of J-2, the intelligence boys, his sense of failure would have been complete indeed. "That's it, sir. Yokota, Mizawa, and Kadena are all off the net. Nobody's picking up." "How many people?" Jackson asked. "Total, about 2,000, mainly mechanics, radar controllers, loggies, that sort of thing. Maybe an airplane or two in transit, but not many of those. I have people checking now," the major replied. "How about the Navy?" "We have people at Anderson on Guam, co-located with your base. The port, too, maybe 1,000 people total. It's a lot smaller than it used to be." Jackson lifted his secure phone and punched in the numbers for SyncPAC. "Admiral Seaton, this is Jackson again. Anything else?" "We can't raise anybody west of Midway, Rob. It's starting to look real."
"How does this thing work?" Oreza asked.
"I hate to say this, but I'm not sure. I didn't bother reading the manual," Burroughs admitted. The sat phone was sitting on the coffee table, its antenna extended through the drill hole in the bottom of the mixing bowl, which was in turn sitting atop two piles of books. "I'm not sure if it broadcasts its position to the satellites periodically or not," for which reason they felt it necessary to maintain the comical arrangement.
"You turn mine off by putting the antenna back down," Isabel Oreza observed, causing two male heads to turn. "Well, you can just take the batteries out, right?"
"Damn," Burroughs managed to say at first, but not by much. He lifted the bowl off, put the little antenna back in its hole, then flipped off the battery cover and withdrew the two AA's. The phone was now completely off.
Ma'am, if you want to get into the master's program at Sanford, use me as a reference, okay?
Ladies and gentlemen, heads turned in the living room to see a smiling man in green fatigues. His English was letter perfect.
I am General Tokikichi Arima of the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Forces. Please allow me to explain what has happened today.
First of all, let me assure you that there is no cause for alarm. There was an unfortunate shooting at the police substation adjacent to your parliament building, but the two police officers who were hurt in the exchange are both doing well in your local hospital. If you have heard rumors of violence or death, those rumors are not true, the general assured the 29,000 citizens of Saipan. You probably want to know what has happened, he went on. Early today, forces under my command began arriving on Saipan and Guam. As you know from your history, and indeed as some of the older citizens on this island well remember, until 1944 the Mariana Islands were possessions of Japan. It may surprise some of you to know that since the court decision several years ago allowing Japanese citizens to purchase real estate in the islands, the majority of the land on Saipan and Guam is owned by my countrymen. You also know of our love and affection for these islands and the people who live here. We have invested billions of dollars here and created a renaissance in the local economy after years of shameful neglect by the American government. Therefore, we are not really strangers at all, are we? You probably also know that there have been great difficulties between Japan and America. Those difficulties have forced my country to rethink our defense priorities. We have therefore decided to reestablish our ownership of the Mariana Islands as a purely defensive measure to safeguard our own shores against possible American action. In other words, it is necessary for us to maintain defense forces here and therefore to bring the Marianas back into our country. Now, General Arima smiled, what does this mean to you, the citizens of Saipan?
Really, it means nothing at all. All businesses will remain open. We, too, believe in free enterprise. You will continue to manage your own affairs through your own elected officials, with the additional benefit that you will have status as Japan's 48th prefecture, with full parliamentary representation in the Diet. That is something you have not had as an American Commonwealth, which is just another word for colony, isn't it? You will have dual citizenship rights. We will respect your culture and your language. Your freedom to travel will not be impeded. Your freedoms of speech, press, religion, and assembly will be the same as those enjoyed by all Japanese citizens, and totally identical with the civil rights you now enjoy. In short, nothing is going to change in your daily life at all. Another charming smile. The truth of the matter is that you will greatly benefit from this change in government. As part of Japan, you will be part of the world's most vibrant and dynamic economy. Even more money will come to your island. You will see prosperity such as you have never dreamed of, Arima assured his audience. The only changes you will experience will be positive ones. On that you have my word and the word of my government. Perhaps you say that such words are easy to speak, and you are correct. Tomorrow you will see people on the streets and roads of Saipan, surveying, taking measurements, and interviewing local citizens. Our first important task will be to improve the roads and highways of your island, something neglected by the Americans. We want your advice on the best way to do this. In fact, we will welcome your help and participation in everything we do. Now, Arima said, leaning forward somewhat, I know that some among you will find these developments unwelcome, and I wish to apologize sincerely for that. We have no desire to harm anyone here, but you must understand that any attack upon one of my men or any Japanese citizen will be treated as a violation of the law. I am also responsible to take certain security measures to protect my troops, and to bring this island into compliance with Japanese law.
All firearms owned by private citizens on Saipan must be surrendered in the next few days. You may bring them into your local police stations. If you have a sales record for the guns, or if you can demonstrate their commercial value, we will pay you the fair cash value for them. Similarly, we must ask that any owners of ham radios turn them over to us for a short period of time, and please not to use them until you do. Again, we will pay in cash the full value of your property, and in the case of the radios, when we return them to you, you may keep the money as a token of our thanks for your cooperation. Aside from that, another smile, you will hardly notice that we are here. My troops are under orders to treat everyone on this island as fellow citizens. If you experience or even see a single incident in which a Japanese soldier is impolite to a local citizen, I want you to come to my headquarters and report it. You see, our law applies to us, too. For the moment, please go about your normal lives. A number came up on the screen. If you have any specific questions, please call this number, or feel free to come to my headquarters at your Parliament building. We will be glad to help you in any way we can. Thank you for listening. Good night. This message will be repeated every 15 minutes on Channel 6, the public access channel, another voice said.
Son of a bitch, Areza breathed. I wonder who their ad agency is, Burroughs noted, going to punch the rewind button on the VCR.
Can we believe it? Isabel asked.
Who knows?
You have any guns? Portugis shook his head.
Nope, I don't even know if this rock has a registration law. Have to be crazy to take on soldiers anyway, right?
It makes it a lot easier for them if they don't have to watch their backs. Burroughs started putting the batteries back in his sat phone.
You have the number for that, Admiral?
Jackson.
Master Chief Areza, sir. You got a tape machine running?
Yes, I do. What you got?
Well, sir, it's official, Areza reported dryly.
They just made the announcement on TV. We taped it. I'm turning the tape on now. I'll hold the phone right next to the speaker.
General Tokikichi Arima, Jackson wrote down on a pad. He handed it to an army sergeant.
Have the intel boys identify this name.
Yes, sir.
The sergeant vanished in an instant.
Major! Robbie called next.
Yes, Admiral.
The sound quality is pretty good. Have a copy of the tape run over to the spooks for voice stress analysis. Next, I want a typed transcript ASAP ready to fax out to 500,000 places.
Right.
For the rest of the time, Jackson just listened, an island of calm in a sea of madness, or so it seemed.
That's it, Areza told him when it ended. You want the call-in number, Admiral?
Not right now.
Good job, Master Chief. Anything else to report?
The airplanes are still shuttling in. I counted 14 since we talked last.
Okay. Robbie made the proper notes. You feel like you're in any particular danger?
I don't see people running around with guns, Admiral.
You notice they didn't say anything about American nationals on the island.
No. I didn't.
Good point.
Ouch.
I ain't real comfortable about this, sir.
Areza gave him a quick reprise of the incident on his boat.
I can't say that I blame you, Master Chief. Your country's working on the problem, okay?
You say so, Admiral. I'm shutting down for a while.
Fair enough.
Hang in there, Jackson ordered. It was a hollow directive, and both men knew it.
Roger that. Out.
Robbie sat the phone back in the cradle.
Opinions?
You mean aside from it's all fucking crazy? A staff officer inquired.
It may be crazy to us, but it sure is hell logical to somebody.
There was no sense in clobbering the officer for the statement, Jackson knew. It would take a bit more time before they really came to terms with the situation.
Does anybody not believe the information we have now?
He looked around. 7 officers were present, and people weren't selected for duty in the NMCC for their stupidity.
It may be crazy, sir, but everything keeps coming down the same way. Every post we've tried to link with is off the air. They're all supposed to have duty officers, but nobody's answering the phone. Satellite links are down. We have 4 Air Force bases and an Army post off the air. It's real, sir. The staffer redeemed herself with a follow-up. Anything from State? Any of the spook shops? Nothing, a colonel from J-2 replied. I can give you a satellite pass over the Marianas in about an hour. I've already told NRO and ITAC about the tasking and the priority. KH-11? Yes, sir, and all the cameras are up. Weather is clear. We'll get good overheads, the intelligence officer assured him. No storm in the area yesterday. Negative, another officer said. Ain't no reason for phone service to be out. They have transpac cable and satellite uplinks. I called the contractor that operates the dishes. They had no warning at all. They've been sending their own signals to their people, requesting information. No reply. Jackson nodded. He'd waited this long only to get the confirmation he needed to take the next step. Okay. Let's get a warning signal drafted, distribution to all the sinks, alert SecDef and the chiefs. I'm calling the president now. Dr. Ryan, NMCC on the stew with critic traffic. Admiral Robert Jackson again. The use of critic caused heads to turn as Ryan lifted the secure phone. Robbie, this is Jack. What's happening? Everyone in the communications room saw the National Security Advisor turn pale. Robbie, are you serious? He looked at the communications watch officer. Where are we now? Approaching Goose Bay, Labrador, sir, about 3 hours out. Get Special Agent D'Agostino up here, would you please? Ryan took his hand off the phone. Robbie, I need hard copy. Okay. He's still asleep, I think. Give me 30 minutes to get organized here. Call me if you need me. Jack got out of his chair and made his way to the lab just aft of the flight deck. He managed to avoid looking in the mirror when he washed his hands. The Secret Service agent was waiting for him when he emerged. Not much sleep for you, eh? Is the boss up yet? Sir, he left orders not to do that until we were an hour out. I just checked with the pilot and kick him loose, Dagger, right now. Then get Secretaries Hansen and Fiedler up, Arnie, too. What's the matter, sir? You'll be in there to hear it. Ryan took the roll of fax paper off the secure machine and started reading. He looked up. I'm not kidding, Dagger, right now. Any danger to the president? Let's assume that there is, Jack replied. He thought for a second. Where's the nearest fighter base, Lieutenant? The what? On her face was quite obvious. Sir, there are F-15s at Otis on Cape Cod and F-16s at Burlington, Vermont. Both are Air National Guard groups tasked to continental air defense. You call them and tell them that the president would like to have some friends around ASAP. The nice thing about talking to lieutenants was that they weren't used to asking why an order was given, even when there was no obvious reason for it. The same thing didn't apply to the Secret Service. Doc, if you need to do that, then I need to know, too, right now. Yeah, Dag, I guess so. Ryan tore off the top section of the thermal fax paper when he got to the second page of the transmission. Holy shit, the agent thought aloud, handing it back. I'll wake the president up. You need to tell the pilot they do things a little differently at times like this. Fair enough. 15 minutes, Dagger, okay? Yes, sir. She headed down the circular stairs while Jack went forward to the flight deck. 160 minutes to go, Dr. Ryan. Has been a long one, hasn't it? The colonel at the controls asked pleasantly. The smile faded instantly from his face. It was mere chance that took them past the American embassy. Maybe he just wanted to see the flag, Clark thought. It was always a pleasant sight in a foreign land, even if it did fly over a building designed by some bureaucrat with the artistic sense of... Somebody's worried about security, Chavez said. Yevgeny Pavlovich, I know your English is good. You need not practice it on me. Excuse me. The Japanese are concerned with a riot, Vanya? Except for that one incident, there hasn't been much hooliganism. His voice trailed off. There were 2 squads of fully armed infantrymen arrayed around the building. That seemed very odd indeed. Over here, Ding thought, 1 or 2 police officers seemed enough to... Yabtvoyumat.
Clark was proud of the lad just then. Foul as the imprecation was, it was also just what a Russian would have said. The reason for it was also clear. The guards around the embassy perimeter were looking in as much as they were looking out, and the Marines were nowhere to be seen.
Ivan Sergeyevich, something seems very odd.
Indeed it does, Yevgeny Pavlovich, John Clark said evenly. He didn't let the car slow down and hoped the troops on the sidewalk wouldn't notice the two gaijin driving by and take down their license number. It might be a good time to change rental cars.
The name is Arima. First name, Tokikichi, sir. Lieutenant General, age 53. The Army Sergeant was an intelligence specialist. Graduated their National Defense Academy, worked his way up the line as an infantryman, good marks all the way. He's airborne qualified, took the senior course at Carlisle Barracks 8 years ago, did just fine. Politically astute, the form sheet says, well connected. He's commanding general of their Eastern Army, a rough equivalent of a corps organization in the U.S. Army, but not as heavy in corps-level assets, especially artillery. That's two infantry divisions, 1st and 12th, their 1st Airborne Brigade, 1st Engineer Brigade, 2nd Anti-Air Group, and other administrative attachments. The sergeant handed over the folder, complete with a pair of photos. The enemy has a face now, Jackson thought. At least one face. Jackson examined it for a few seconds and closed the folder back. It was about to go to condition frantic in the Pentagon. The first of the Joint Chiefs was in the parking lot, and he was the lucky son of a bitch to give them the news, such as it was. Jackson assembled his documents and headed off to the tank, a pleasant room, actually, located on the outside of the building's E-ring. Chet Namuri had spent the day meeting at irregular hours with three of his contacts, learning not very much except that something very strange was afoot, though nobody knew what. His best course of action, he decided, was to head back to the bathhouse and hope Kazuo Teoko would turn up. He finally did, by which time Namuri had spent so much time soaking in the blisteringly hot water that his body felt like pasta that had been in the pot for about a month.
"You must have had a day like I did," he managed to say with a crooked smile.
"How was yours?" Kazuo asked, his smile tired but enthusiastic.
"There is a pretty girl at a certain bar.
3 months I've worked on her. We had a vigorous afternoon." Namuri reached below the surface of the water, feigning agony in an obvious way.
"It may never work again."
"I wish that American girl was still around," Taoka said, settling in the tub with a prolonged, "Ah! I am ready for someone like her now."
"She's gone?" Namuri asked innocently.
"Dead," the salaryman said, easily controlling his sense of loss.
"What happened?"
"They were going to send her home. Yamata sent Kaneda, his security man, to tidy things up. But it seems she used narcotics and she was found dead of an overdose. A great pity," Taoka observed, as if he were describing the demise of a neighbor's cat. "But there are more where she came from." Namuri just nodded with weary impassivity, remarking to himself that this was a side of the man he hadn't seen before. Kazuo was a fairly typical Japanese salaryman. He joined his company right out of college, starting off in a position little removed from clerkship. After serving 5 years, he'd been sent off to a business school, which in this country was the intellectual equivalent of Paris Island with a touch of Buchenwald. There was just something outrageous about how this country operated. He expected that things would be different. It was a foreign land, after all, and every country was different, which was fundamentally a good thing. America was the proof of that. America essentially lived off the diversity that arrived at her shores, each ethnic community adding something to the national pot, creating an often boiling but always creative and lively national mix. But now he truly understood why people came to the U.S., especially people from this country. Japan demanded much of its citizens, or more properly, its culture did. The boss was always right. A good employee was one who did as he was told.
To advance, you had to kiss a lot of ass, sing the company song, exercise like somebody in goddamn boot camp every morning, showing up an hour early to show how sincere you were. The amazing part was that anything creative happened here at all. Probably the best of them fought their way to the top despite all this, or perhaps were smart enough to disguise their inner feelings until they got to a position of real authority, but by the time they got there, they must have accumulated enough inner rage to make Hitler look like a pansy. Along the way, they bled those feelings off with drinking binges and sexual orgies of the sort he'd heard about in this very hot tub. The stories about jaunts to Thailand and Taiwan, and most recently the Marianas, were especially interesting, stuff that would have made his college chums at UCLA blush. Those things were all symptoms of a society that cultivated psychological repression, whose warm and gentle facade of good manners was like a dam holding back all manner of repressed rage and frustration. That dam occasionally leaked, mostly in an orderly, controlled way, but the strain on the dam was unchanging, and one result of that strain was a way of looking at others, especially Gai Jin, in a manner that insulted Nomuri's American-cultivated egalitarian outlook. It would not be long, he realized, before he started hating this place. That would be unhealthy and unprofessional, the CIA officer thought, remembering the repeated lessons from the farm. A good field spook identified closely with the culture he attacked. But he was sliding in the other direction, and the irony was that the deepest reason for his growing antipathy was that his roots sprang from this very country. "You really want more like her?" Nomuri asked, eyes closed. "Oh, yes. Fucking Americans will soon be our national sport," Taoka chuckled. "We had a fine time of it the past 2 days, and I was there to see it all happen." His voice concluded in awe. It had all paid off. 20 years of towing the line had brought its reward, to have been there in the war room, listening to it all, following it all, seeing history written before his eyes. The salaryman had made his mark, and most importantly of all, he'd been noticed by Yamata-san himself. "So, what great deeds have happened while I was performing my own, eh?" Nomuri asked, opening his eyes and giving off a leering smile. "We just went to war with America, and we won," Taoka proclaimed. "War? Nanja? We accomplished a takeover of General Motors, did we?" "A real war, my friend. We crippled their Pacific fleet, and the Marianas Islands are Japanese again." "My friend, you cannot tolerate too much alcohol," Nomuri thought, really believing what he just said to the blowhard. "I have not had a drink in 4 days, Taoka protested. "What I told you is true." "Kazuo," Chet said patiently, as though to a bright child, "you tell stories with a skill and style better than any man I have ever met. Your descriptions of women make my loins swell as though I were there myself," Nomuri smiled. "But you exaggerate." "Not this time, my friend, truly," Taoka said, really wanting his friend to believe him, and so he started giving details. Nomuri had no real military training. Most of his knowledge of such affairs came from reading books and watching movies. His instructions for operating in Japan had nothing to do with gathering information on the Japanese self-defense forces, but rather with trade and foreign affairs matters. But Kazuo Taoka was a fine storyteller with a keen eye for detail, and it took only 3 minutes before Nomuri had to close his eyes again, a smile fixed on his lips. Both actions were the result of his training in Yorktown, Virginia, as was that of his memory, which struggled now to record every single word, while another part of his consciousness wondered how the hell he was going to get the information out. His other reaction was one that Taoka could neither see nor hear, a quintessential Americanism spoken within the confines of the CIA officer's mind. "You motherfuckers." "Okay, Jumper is up and pretty much put together," Helen D'Agostino said. Jasmine, the code name for Anne Durling,
will be in another cabin. Sextate and Sectrez are up and having their coffee. Arnie Van Dam is probably in better shape than anybody aboard. Showtime. How about the fighters?
They'll join up in about 20 minutes. We went with the F-15s out of Otis. Better range. They'll follow us all the way down.
I'm really being paranoid on that, ain't I?
Daga's eyes gave off a coldly professional smile.
You know what I've always liked about you, Dr. Ryan?
What's that?
I don't have to explain security to you like I do with everybody else. You think just like I do.
It was a lot for a Secret Service agent to say.
The President is waiting, sir.
She led him down the stairs.
Ryan bumped into his wife on the way forward. Pretty as ever, she was not suffering from the previous night, despite her husband's warning, and on seeing Jack, she almost made a joke that it was he who'd had the problem.
What's the matter?
Business, Kathy.
Bad?
Her husband just nodded and went forward past a Secret Service agent and an armed Air Force security policeman. The two convertible couches had been made up. President Durling was sitting down in suit pants and white shirt. His tie and jacket were not in evidence at this time. A silver pot of coffee was on the low table. Ryan could see out the windows on both sides of the nose cabin. They were flying 1,000 feet or so above fleecy cumulus clouds.
"I hear you've been up all night, Jack," Durling said.
"Since before Iceland, whenever that was, Mr. President," Ryan told him.
He hadn't washed, hadn't shaved, and his hair probably looked like Kathy's after a long procedure under a surgical cap. Worse still was the look in his eyes as he prepared to deliver grimmer news than he'd ever spoken.
"You look like hell. What's the problem?"
"Mr. President, based on information received over the last few hours, I believe that the United States of America is at war with Japan."
"What you need is a good chief to run this for you," Jones observed.
"Ron, one more of those and I'll toss you in the break, okay? You've thrown enough weight around for one day,"
Mancuso replied in a weary voice.
"Those people were under my command, remember?"
"Have I been that much of a jerk?"
"Yeah, Jonesy, you have." Chambers handled that answer. "Maybe Seaton needed to be brought up short once, but you overdid it big time. And now we need solutions, not smart-ass bullshit."
Jones nodded but kept his own counsel.
"Very well, sir. What assets do we have?"
"Best estimate, they have 18 boats deployable. Two are in overhaul status and are probably unavailable for months at least," Chambers replied, doing the enemy first. "With Charlotte and Asheville out of the game, we have a total of 17. Four of those are in yard overhaul and unavailable. Four more are in bobtail refits alongside the pier here or in Dago. Another four are in the I.O. Maybe we can shake those loose, maybe we can't. That leaves 5. Three of those are with the carriers for the exercise. One's right down below at the pier. The last one's at sea up in the Gulf of Alaska doing workups. That has a new CO. What, just 3 weeks since he relieved?"
"Correct," Mancuso nodded. "He's just learning the job."
"Jesus, the cupboard's that bare?"
Jones was now regretting his comment on having a good chief around. "The mighty United States Pacific Fleet, as recently as 5 years ago, the most powerful naval force in the history of civilization, was now a frigate navy."
5 of us, 18 of them, and they're all spun up to speed. They've been running ops for the last couple of months." Chambers looked at the wall chart and frowned.
"That's one big fucking ocean, Jonesy."
It was the way he added the last statement that worried the contractor.
"The 4 in refits?"
"That order's out. Expedite readiness for sea. And that brings the number to 9 in a couple of weeks if we're lucky."
"Mr. Chambers, sir?"
Chambers turned back.
"Yeah, Petty Officer Jones."
"Remember when we used to head up north all alone, tracking 4 or 5 of the bad guys at once?"
The operations officer nodded soberly, almost nostalgically. His reply was quiet.
"Long time ago, Jonesy.
We're dealing with SSKs now on their home turf, and did you trade your balls in to get that 4th stripe on your shoulder?"
Chambers turned around in an instant rage.
"You listen to me, boy. I..."
But Ron Jones just snarled back.
"Aye, hell. You used to be a kick-ass officer. I trusted you to know what to do with the data I gave you, just like I trusted him. Jones pointed to Admiral Mancuso. When I sailed with you guys, we were the class of the whole fucking world. And if you did your job right as a CO, and if you've been doing your job right as a type commander, Bart, then those kids out there still are. God damn it, when I tossed my bag down the hatch on Dallas the first time, I trusted you guys to know your damn job. Was I wrong, gentlemen? Remember the motto on Dallas? First in harm's way? What the hell's the matter here? The question hung in the air for several seconds. Chambers was too angry to take it in. Subpac was not.
We look that bad? Mancuso asked.
Sure as hell, sir. Okay, we took it in the ass from these bastards. Time to start thinking about catch-up. We're the varsity, aren't we? Who's better suited to it than we are?
Jones, you always did have a big mouth, Chambers said. Then he looked back at the chart. But I guess maybe it's time to go to work.
A chief petty officer stuck his head in the door.
Sir, Pasadena just checked in from down the hill, ready in all respects to get underway. The CO requests orders.
How's he loaded? Mancuso replied, knowing that if he'd really done his job right over the past few days, the question would have been unnecessary.
22 ADCAPs, 6 harpoons, and 12 TLAM Cs. They're all war shots, the chief replied. He's ready to rock, sir.
Comsubpack nodded. Tell him to stand by for mission orders.
Aye, aye, sir.
Good skipper? Jones asked.
He got the Battle E last year, Chambers said.
Tim Perry. He was my XO on Key West. He'll do.
So, now all he needs is a job.
Mancuso lifted the secure phone for SyncPAC.
Yeah.
Signal from the State Department, the Air Force communications officer said, entering the room. The Japanese ambassador requests an urgent meeting with the president.
Brett. We see what he has to say, Sextate said. Ryan nodded agreement.
Any chance at all that this is some kind of mistake? Durling asked.
We expect some hard intelligence any time now from a satellite pass over the Marianas.
It's dark there, but that won't matter much. Ryan had finished his briefing, and on completion, the data he'd managed to deliver seemed very thin. The baseline truth here was that what had evidently taken place was so wildly beyond the limits of reason that he himself would not be fully satisfied until he saw the overheads himself.
If it's real, then what?
That will take a little time, Ryan admitted. We want to hear what their ambassador has to say.
What are they really up to? Treasury Secretary Fiedler asked.
Unknown, sir. Just pissing us off isn't worth the trouble. We have nukes, they don't.
It's all crazy, Ryan said quietly.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
Then he remembered that in 1939, Germany's biggest trading partner had been France.
History's most often repeated lesson was that logic was not a constant in the behavior of nations. The study of history was not always bilateral, and the lessons learned from history depended on the quality of the student. Worth remembering, Jack thought, because the other guy might forget.
It's got to be some kind of mistake, Hansen announced. A couple of accidents. Maybe our two subs collided under water, and maybe we have some excitable people on Saipan. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all.
I agree. The data does not form any clear picture. But the individual pieces?
Damn it, I know Robbie Jackson. I know Bart Mancuso.
Who's that?
Comms Subpack. He owns all our subs out there. I sailed with him once. Jackson is Deputy J3, and we've been friends since we were both teaching at Annapolis, lo, these many years ago.
Okay, Durling said. You've told us everything you know.
Yes, Mr. President. Every word without any analysis.
Meaning you don't really have any.
The question stung some, but this was not a time for embroidering.
Ryan nodded.
Correct, Mr. President.
So, for now, we wait.
How long to Andrews?
Fiedler looked out a window.
That's the Chesapeake B,
bay below us now. We can't be too far out.
Press at the airport?
He asked Arnie Van Dam.
Just the ones in the back of the plane, sir.
Ryan?
We firm up our information as fast as we can. The services are all on alert.
What are those fighters doing out there? Fiedler asked.
They were now flying a Beam Air Force One in a tight two-ship element about a mile away, their pilots wondering what this was all about. Ryan wondered if the press would take note of it.
Well, how long could this affair remain a secret?
My idea, Buzz, Ryan said. Might as well take responsibility for it.
A little dramatic, don't you think?
Sextate inquired.
We didn't expect to have our fleet attacked either, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Colonel Evans. We're now approaching Andrews Air Force Base. We all hope you've enjoyed the flight. Please bring your seat backs to the upright position, and in the back, the junior White House aides ostentatiously refused to fasten their seat belts. The cabin crew did what they were supposed to do, of course.
Ryan felt the main gear thumped down on runway 01 right. For the majority of the people aboard, the press, it was the end. For him, it was just the beginning. The first sign was the larger-than-normal complement of security police waiting at the terminal building, and some especially nervous Secret Service agents. In a way, it was a relief to the National Security Advisor. Not everyone thought it was some sort of mistake, but it would be so much better, Ryan thought, if he were wrong just this once. Otherwise, they faced the most complex crisis in his country's history.
Chapter 24, Running in Place. If there was a worse feeling than this one, Clark didn't know what it might be. Their mission in Japan was supposed to have been easy, evacuate an American citizen who had gotten herself into a tight spot and ascertain the possibility of reactivating an old and somewhat dusty intelligence network.
Well, that was the idea, the officer told himself, heading to his room. Chavez was parking the car. They decided to rent a new one, and again the clerk at the counter had changed his expression on learning that their credit card was printed in both Roman and Cyrillic characters. It was an experience so new as to have no precedent at all. Even at the height or depths of the Cold War, Russians had treated American citizens with greater deference than their own countrymen, and whether that had resulted from curiosity or not, the privilege of being American had been an important touchstone for a lonely stranger in a foreign and hostile land. Never had Clark felt so frightened, and it was little consolation that Ding Chavez didn't have the experience to realize just how unusual and dangerous their position was. It was, therefore, something of a relief to feel the piece of tape on the underside doorknob. Maybe Nomori could give him some useful information. Clark went in the room only long enough to use the bathroom before heading right back out. He saw Chavez in the lobby and made the appropriate gesture. Stay put. Clark noticed with a smile that his junior partner had stopped at a bookstore and purchased a copy of a Russian-language newspaper, which he carried ostentatiously as a kind of defensive measure. 2 minutes later, Clark was looking in the window of the camera shop again. There wasn't much street traffic, but enough that he wasn't the only one around. As he stood looking at the latest automated wonder from Nikon, he felt someone bump into him.
"Watch where you're going," a gruff voice said in English and moved on. Clark took a few seconds before heading in the other direction, turning the corner and heading down an alley. A minute later, he found a shadowy place and waited. Nomori was there quickly.
"This is dangerous, kid."
"Why do you think I hit you with that signal?" Nomori's voice was low and shaky.
It was field craft from a TV series, about as realistic and professional as two kids sneaking a smoke in the boys' room of their junior high. The odd part was that, important as it was, Nomori's message occupied about 1 minute. The rest of the time was concerned with procedural matters.
"Okay. Number one, no contact at all with your normal rat line. Even if they're allowed out on the street, you don't know them. You don't go near them. Your contact points are gone, kid. You understand?" Clark's mind was going at light speed toward nowhere at the moment.
but the most immediate priority was survival. You had to be alive in order to accomplish something, and Nomuri, like Chavez and himself, were illegals, unlikely to receive any sort of clemency after arrest and totally separated from any